This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, December 2nd, 2019, and this is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Ahead on the program this hour, photographs from the New York Post are part of the special collections at the University of Arkansas's Mullins Library. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek finds out how the more than a million photos are being cataloged. Later today on 91.3 on NPR's Here and Now, former airline CEO and current Amtrak head Richard Anderson is trying to make the railroad break even for the first time ever, and he's doing it for a salary of nothing. A conversation with Anderson about his life's journey, plus the afternoon's news on Here and Now this afternoon from 1 to 3 on 91.3 KUAF. The holiday season is in full gear, and the Ozarks Philharmonic Youth Orchestra's winter concert will provide a seasonal soundtrack tonight at 7:30. The concert will be at Arkansas Arts Academy on West Poplar Street in Rogers. More details at the Facebook page for Ozark Philharmonic Youth Orchestra. Further east in Harrison, another chance to take in a Christmas parade. That parade begins at Harrison Junior High at 7 o'clock tonight. This is Ozarks at Large. The city of Fayetteville has five designated historic districts, but no preservation ordinances are on the books. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the Historic District Commission is circulating two petitions to gauge interest for a preservation code specifically for the Washington Willow Historic District.
The Washington Willow Historic District, east of downtown Fayetteville, features 19th century Victorian and Revival-style mansions, early 20th century craftsmen and bungalow-style homes, as well as modern 1950s ranch-style houses. In 1980, a large section of the neighborhood was listed on the National Register of Historic Places. After a derelict mansion on Lafayette was torn down several years ago to build a new contemporary structure and another home recently demolished, some district residents became concerned. Melissa Werner says her neighborhood is worth conserving.
The homes are very pretty. Some of them are grand, some of them are smaller, but they're all lovely and unique in their own ways.
Her 3,000-square-foot classical revival home, built in 1904, was recently renovated. Building permits are required for major construction, but no preservation permits are required for historic structures in Fayetteville.
I like the idea of protecting the district from demolishing buildings, and I know there's other neighborhoods in the country that happens to. People buy a lot, tear down the house, and build a nice big house that doesn't really sit within the neighborhood well. And I like preserving the history of the neighborhood, but at the same time, I want people to have some degree of freedom.
The Fayetteville Historic District Commission was created in 1979 to foster and encourage preservation of historic structures in the city. Late last year, a first set of historic preservation guidelines specifically for Washington Willow District were drawn up, with funding and support from city council, planners, and advice from district residents. Fayetteville Planning Director Andrew Garner says the 115-page Washington Willow Historic District Design Review Manual cost around $18,000 to produce and publish.
And it was probably a six-month process. You know, we had a consultant come in that's kind of a national, renowned historic preservationist.
To come up with guidelines, property owners were surveyed, followed by neighborhood meetings with Thomason and Associates, preservation planners out of Nashville, Tennessee, and Fayetteville Historic District commissioners. The guidelines, however, serve as a preservation template, not a mandate, Garner says.
So if somebody is interested in rehabbing their property, their architect could look at that and follow that in order to make sure that the renovations are kind of true and match up with the character of the neighborhood.
Garner says, even though Washington Willow Historic District is on the National Register, preservation rules are enforced only at the local level.
Ours is not a museum-quality neighborhood, Washington Willow. It's, you know, like Eureka Springs really does have some, their neighborhoods are really intact and some really fantastic examples of the architecture. Washington Willow is a bit more eclectic. You know, there, some homes are preserved really, really well and some aren't. And then there's mix of chain link fence and all these different types of things. So our guidelines speak to that. But procedurally, it's the same process that if you do want to go through and renovate your house, you would have to get a certificate of appropriateness.
Two petition signing events, one held November 23rd and a second to be held December 7th, hosted by Fayetteville Historic District Commission at Washington County Historical Society Headquarters House on East Dixon, are being arranged to gauge interest in enacting a preservation code based on the design guidelines.
We have had a great flow of neighbors coming through today. So far, we're very pleased. We need to hear from a lot more people.
Commissioner Katie Mihalovich and her family live in the district just outside the National Register boundary.
There are no regulations in place to protect structures within the neighborhood, within the historic boundary. So this would add just one more layer to the building permitting process, where if someone was going to be doing any work on their property that is visible from the right-of-way that falls under the mandatory guidelines listed, then we would want that project to be presented to the Historic District Commission for design review and approval.
Mihalovich says district property owners, both inside and just outside the boundary, are being asked to sign two separate petitions. Over 200 individual properties are contained within the National Register Historic District, she says.
So we certainly have most of the homes along North Washington, most of the homes along North Willow, most of the homes along East Dixon and East Sutton Street, as well as about half of East Maple Street.
Numerous valuable historic structures surround the Washington Willow Historic District as well.
We want to cultivate a sense of place and promote the use of historic architecture and the built environment for education, enjoyment, and well-being of the residents and for visitors, and to encourage preservation of our historic integrity in land use and in development planning.
If enacted, a preservation code will require HDC review of any demolition, new construction, new windows, retaining walls, siding, and more. Paint colors, lighting, roofing, fencing, garages, awnings, and chimneys, however, fall under advisory guidelines. Historic District Commissioner Jason Smith, who lives in the Washington Willow District, has been pressing for a preservation code for several years now.
Yeah, just hoping we have support and that the neighborhood, you know, thinks it's something that would help keep that for future generations.
The petitions will be available to the public for signing at Washington County Historical Society Headquarters House. Petition initiative results will be presented to the December 12th meeting of the Fayetteville Historic District Commission. If over 50% of district property owners sign on, the petitions will be forwarded to City Council for consideration, likely early next year. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And you can find a link to the Washington Willow Historic District Design Review Manual on OzarksAtLarge.com. And this reminder, you can find past editions of our shows, plus individual stories and interviews at OzarksAtLarge.com. Mullins Library at the University of Arkansas is now home to the New York Post Photo Archive. It includes more than a million photographs and negatives that span the 20th century. Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek spoke with Dennis Clark, the Dean of Libraries, and Lori Burrell, the Associate Dean for Special Collections, about the trove of artifacts.
Was it a surprise to get this trove of photographs?
It was a really unusual thing for us to get at the University of Arkansas. It wasn't anything that we went out seeking. So the archive is fundamentally the as far as we can tell, the complete photo archive of the New York Post, they stopped making prints and they stopped keeping prints. It's 2010 or 2000s or so. And so it includes about 1.38 million individual items, and it takes up about 1,492 boxes, and it came to the university on two different box trucks, and so right now it sits on a library storage facility. It came to the university through donors who have a connection with the university, who wish to remain anonymous, but had acquired the New York Post Archive themselves.
Any idea why, while remaining anonymous, why they were drawn to this collection?
I would imagine it's because they saw an opportunity to monetize it. The collection has been digitized and it's completely, and that digital images are licensed through Getty Images now. So newspapers and journalists around the world still can pull this information down. But what we have is the print archive, the actual fundamental photographs, the prints, the negatives, number of different kinds of formats. Those are the things that we have. The research value for us is different.
So what is the research value of having these physical objects when they are digitized and exist somewhere else?
So that's a really good question, and that's something we're still trying to figure out. So we have this amazing collection. It will have research value. The question about what that value is unclear because we don't really know what it is yet. We took the donation, the university accepted the donation, and we have only just begun to actually get any sense of what's actually included in the archive. We know what it is. I mean, it's the New York Post Photographic Archive, but we don't really know the extent of it. We don't know condition. There are as many unanswered questions right now as there are answered ones.
Right. I mean, it's a huge amount of material. Any idea how you will store it, how it will eventually be perhaps accessible to students or researchers?
Sure. So what our typical path would be is with a collection this size, it'll take it would take us years to make any part of it accessible because we have to understand its context and its scope. We have to understand the intellectual content, intellectual property concerns. So all of these are kind of messy, messy questions that we have to engage in if we're going to do it right. And if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right. So it's going to be a long time before it can be open for research. But once it is, typically our pathway would be to open up the entire collection for research at once we feel like we have intellectual control on it.
And any idea what kind of images at this point that this collection contains and how far back they go?
Most of the photographs are between the 1920s and the early 2000s, but we know we have some photographs that go back into the 19th century. So it's a fairly broad, broad collection of photos and prints and other kinds of photographic material.
And obviously this is coming from the New York Post, and now it's at the University of Arkansas. So what is the value of having something like the images from the New York Post here in Arkansas?
Well, the New York Post was a national newspaper. It's not a local paper for New York. It really is a national newspaper. So we have strong connections with student journalism. We have strong connections with our journalism program, connections with history, American history, all of which is kind of the archive really is going to touch on because it does span such a large amount of American history.
Any standout images that you know of there yet? And I'm sure there's quite a bit that are sort of everyday life images, but I'm wondering if you guys have had a chance to see anything that kind of struck you as unusual or unique.
You know, we've only opened up a couple of boxes to get a sample, and so I don't think there's anything that has struck us as particularly either iconic that everyone might know. Although the New York Post certainly published photographs that were iconic, and we would expect those to be in those 1,492 boxes somewhere in that 1.38 million volumes. But it's interesting. We looked at some today, and what we saw was some of the first women's photographs of the first women's baseball players at Brown University and some Negro League women's ball players in one folder that we opened. So they're touch points of American history, even in that I would never have thought would might be represented in this archive.
So I'm wondering, in general, what is the value of having photographs that were taken by the New York Post or any newspaper available for research at the U of A or any other university?
Well, I think the historic value of the fact that these were part of American history, that millions of people looked at these photographs once, is really important. And although the photographs to our understanding, are licensed for Getty Images. That's a commercial question, and that's not anything that we as a library rely on to make sure that someone, once it stops being something that someone can make money off of, their interest in it wanes, but our interest will remain. So in looking at a collection like this, an archive like this, we're looking for the long haul and for access to information and access to photographs that go beyond what someone can easily sell on the internet.
How do you begin to organize a collection of this size to make it easily searchable once people are allowed to start looking at it?
So with a collection like this, what we would want to do is open all the boxes, not just the few that we've opened so far, and we'd want to look through and start to create an initial inventory of every single photo as best we can, if not at that granular level, then at least a set of folder titles. So each folder is labeled with a subject, so we'd want to have a complete inventory of that, and we'd turn that into an online inventory, or what we call a finding aid, and that's how it becomes discoverable and researchers know that it's here. So that's the kind of intellectual work that goes into it. But then in terms of the physical organization, a collection like this is a really big undertaking in that to do it right, you want to have all the photographs in acid-free folders. You want to have them all sleeved so that they're protected from fingerprints and light and dust. And then you also want them all in acid-free boxes. So there's a lot of rehousing that'll be involved in this project. We haven't seen the condition of all the photographs yet. We know that there is a little bit of damage here and there, just as you might expect from over 100 years of history. And so that's part of what goes into that physical and intellectual arrangement.
So are there going to be any kind of logistical things that y'all will have to work through in terms of maybe finding space or a way to store them? Because this is a lot of photos.
So right now, as Dean Clark was saying, the photos are at one of our storage facilities. And anytime that a collection comes in, space is certainly something that we think a lot about, because we want to be sure that we're the best stewards of any collection that's part of university libraries. And so thinking about how we provide access to those materials, so how we bring them into our reading room, which is where people access our collections, how we do that, how we make sure that they're available for our students, for exhibits, and other types of outreach, those are all things that go into stewarding a collection like this.
So we discussed a little bit about how these images have been digitized by Getty. How will you kind of navigate how these images are allowed to be used, considering that the physical images are owned now at the U of A, but Getty has this digital collection?
So with any of our physical collections, we provide access for researchers to use them as part of the scholarship that they're producing. And when it comes time for them to publish or to create other works based on those materials, it's their responsibility to secure the copyright and any permissions that they need to do. So we're providing access to the materials, and then those sorts of permissions or any licenses, that's on the researcher to finalize.
Does the U of A have something similar to this, any kind of similar collections of photographs like this that, I don't know, were part of a newspaper archive? Or what kind of images does the U of A typically have possession of?
So we do have a number of photographic archives. They tend to be from the photographers themselves. So we have the papers or the photographs of Jalevi Grice. We also have other photographs from notable Arkansans and others. And those photographs tend to be part of a person's sort of main corpus or their main body of work. We also have a lot of photographs from our own university relations and our student newspaper and other campus publications. So there's been a long kind of collecting history around media and journalism in general.
Thank you both for filling us in and giving us a little glimpse of this collection.
Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
That was Lori Burrell, the Associate Dean for Special Collections, and Dennis Clark, the Dean of Libraries at the University of Arkansas, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzanna Sitek about Mullins Library's acquisition of the New York Post's photo archive.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support comes from Urban Jungle Tropical Plant Care and Rental, offering a variety of indoor plants, living green walls, and outdoor planters for restaurants, offices, and homes. Serving Benton and Washington counties with maintenance-free, month-to-month care and services. 466-5033 or urbanjunglenwa.com. Happy holidays from the KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway, your chance to win a gift from one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Fayetteville Roots Festival, Westwood Gardens, Woodstone Craft Pizza, and others. Winners announced December 13th during the noon edition of Ozarks at Large. KUAF.com for details and to register.
This is Ozarks at Large. Every day there are millions of Americans providing care for a loved one. The Family Caregiver Alliance estimates in the past 12 months, more than 34 million people in the country provided unpaid care to an adult age 50 or older. And of that 34 million, about 15% of the caregivers are providing unpaid care for at least two adults. For our latest conversation about aging and health, we concentrate on unpaid caregivers. We asked Brandy Schneider, Director of Aging Services and Administration at Schmieding Center in Springdale with the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences, to come back to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. She says the term caregiver can have a broad definition.
So what that really includes is a family member, a spouse, or it could be a friend or a neighbor who has a substantial relationship with someone and helps them with their activities of daily living or just running errands for them, just helping them with what they need to do to navigate through the day or the week.
In preparation for this conversation, we've exchanged some statistics. It's approximately 34.2 million Americans who've provided, and this is a big word, unpaid care to an adult age 50 or over in just the last year.
Correct. Correct.
Over 34 million.
Yeah. And I think you're right. Unpaid is the key word. You know, unpaid caregiving really totals more than what Medicaid spends on caregiving, what private pay home care agencies spend on caregiving combined. So we are, as a society, as a community, providing a substantial amount of caregiving for family members, just as informal caregivers, not getting paid for those things that we do for our loved ones every day.
And, of course, familial relationships don't. I mean, you do things for your family throughout the course of life that,
absolutely,
you know, that you don't get
absolutely
paid for. But this is an estimated economic value of over $470 billion.
Correct. I mean, imagine if we were actually having to pay for that as a society, how much that would cost us in addition to what we're already paying for the formal caregiving services.
Doesn't mean, though, that being a caregiver for a loved one doesn't have a cost. It can affect the physical and mental and emotional well-being of a caregiver?
Absolutely. So, you know, most caregivers, I would say when I'm in a group of people and I ask them how many are caregivers, many of them don't even raise their hands because they don't realize that they're caregivers. They're just son or daughter or partner or spouse who is providing care as an extension of what they would do every day for someone. But they truly are caregivers, and being a caregiver really does take an emotional and physical toll on the person that's providing that care. I don't think we realize how much of a toll that really takes on family caregivers. You know, it can affect things. Family caregivers are at a much higher risk for things like depression and anxiety. Cardiovascular risk factors are much higher in family caregivers. Even the ability to heal wounds quickly is compromised in family caregivers. Immune health is certainly compromised. So if I catch the flu as a non-family caregiver, I will get over that flu much more quickly than someone who's providing care for a loved one. And it's just because of the stress that's related to that. And we know what stress can do to our bodies.
And many of these caregivers are also probably perhaps caregivers for younger people, or working a job, or both, or more.
Correct. Yeah, and the economic toll, you know, in addition to just the physical toll that it takes, if someone is working a full-time job, you know, they often have to decrease their hours at work or quit their jobs entirely to help take care of a loved one. You know, many of them also have teenage children or younger children that they're taking care of, so we're right in that sandwich generation where people are trying to take care of their children, but also an adult family member or older adult family member as well. And so, you know, just because you're a caregiver doesn't mean that everything else in your life just stops happening. You're still responsible for you know, everything else that happens in life. You know, if you're not feeling well, if your kids have basketball games and you're trying to take care of mom, you know, caregivers are often sort of torn between how much time do I spend with my children and how much time should I spend caring for my older adult loved one that I'm taking care of.
Okay, I'm about to ask a multi-part question, I think, and answer whichever parts you feel like you can't answer. Okay. What can we do to make sure that caregivers are taken care of as well? And I say we, so let's address the person, self-care, who's a caregiver, we who might know someone, and then we, the royal we, if we can address that, as a society.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, just recognizing the value of those informal caregivers as a society and looking at ways, you know, that we can maybe reimburse people from their care, looking at ways we can have flexible hours in people's jobs so they don't have to quit their jobs in order to take care of a loved one, and just recognizing some of the benefits that we need to give employees to help take care of loved ones. Self-care for caregivers is a really hard thing to do, and I say all the time people are too busy being caregivers to take time out to be a better caregiver. And so one of the things that we can do if we recognize someone as a family caregiver is to give them that gift of time that they can't always give themselves. And the way to do that, you know, we are so good at saying, well, just call me if you need anything, or if you need anything, just let me know. And most caregivers are not going to be, they're just not going to do that because they're too busy to think about, okay, now I have to call someone to help me with this. That's just one more thing that we're adding to their plate. Or they just feel like I can do this on my own, so they don't reach out for help. So, you know, I recommend to people, tell them this is what I'm going to do for you rather than if you need anything, call me. So I'm going to bring dinner over to you Thursday night. Does that night work okay for you? Or I'm going to come and sit with your husband while you go to church Sunday or while you go to book club Wednesday night, and just offer to do that for them so they don't have to put that on their to-do list to remember to reach out and ask for help. So just recognizing that they need help and then just responding accordingly rather than waiting for them to ask. And, you know, maybe most importantly, just thank them for what they're doing. You know, most family members who are being cared for don't always take the time to say thank you to the person who's caring for them. And other family members may not remember to thank the caregiver either. So if you know a caregiver, just thank them for what they're doing for their loved one, because it can be a really thankless job. And sometimes just hearing those words of affirmation can go a long ways in helping them to just get through the next day.
There's also a level of advocacy that a caregiver takes on, because you become the advocate for the loved one you're giving care to.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's hard. We're not necessarily just intuitive about navigating through a healthcare system or advocating for what is best for our loved ones. So, you know, definitely a role of advocacy is definitely taken on by the caregiver. And there are resources in the community to help. So, you know, I would encourage people to reach out for resources just to help navigate some of those healthcare systems, just to help know even what questions to ask. You get into a situation and sometimes you don't even know what questions to ask. We're not all healthcare experts.
Right. So. What are some of those resources?
Yeah, so we are happy to help at the Schmieding Center. We can help navigate through some of those resources, give you some questions to ask, and just connect you with the right places.
Do you know if there is any sort of instruction for medical students or medical professionals how to help a caregiver? I mean, I think so many medical professionals are busy to begin with.
Yeah. We try here at UAMS when we have medical students who go through our medical rotations to really talk to them about caregivers and recognizing what a caregiver looks like and recognizing more of the holistic approach to care. And I think, you know, just as a healthcare profession in general throughout society, we are getting better at recognizing that holistic type of care, that it's not just about the patient sitting in front of you, but if the caregiver can't take care of that person or if the caregiver's stressed, that person's not going to have good health outcomes either. So there really has been, I think, a push towards looking at more of the inter and intradisciplinary approach to healthcare throughout medical schools.
What about loved ones who live a time zone or two away? I mean, you might not be the physical immediate caregiver, but that can take a toll as well?
It can. Yeah, there are unique challenges to being a long-distance caregiver. challenges with just even just arranging doctor's appointments or knowing what to look for if mom is not feeling well. Maybe mom still lives alone, but you're sort of that long-distance caregiver for her, so just even knowing what her health concerns might be or knowing how to access resources from so far away. We do have some geriatric care management-type resources here in Northwest Arkansas that can help long-distance caregivers navigate that. So those geriatric care managers actually just sort of take on the role of the sort of a family member and help to arrange appointments and navigate through some of those resources as well.
Finally, those of us who have the fortune of being in good health right now, can we do something? Can we think about something for the later chapters of our lives that make it easier for people who might be our caregivers in the future?
Yeah, so it's always good to talk to family members about what you want in your life down the road. Complete a living will or some kind of advance directive that talks about what sort of health services you want, what you want if you are not as healthy, what kind of living situations you might want to live in if you can't live on your own. As children and caregivers, we often assume we know what our parents or our family members want, but I know from personal experience what I thought my parents wanted or not, it is not at all what my parents actually want. And so having conversations now before you get to a point you have to make some of those decisions with your loved ones about here is what my expectations are. I do want you to take care of me. I don't want you to move in with me. Just having those conversations so that our caregivers are more equipped and able to make those decisions with us and on our behalf.
And if people want to know more, contact the Schmieding Center?
Yes. So the Schmieding Center, 479-751-3043, or you can go to schmiedingcenter.org.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Brandi Schneider is Director of Aging Services and Administration at Schmieding Center in Springdale with the University of Arkansas Medical Sciences Northwest Arkansas campus. Our conversation, a continuation of a series of discussions about aging and health with professionals from the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. Now, with safety in mind, a helmet giveaway for scooter riders on the University of Arkansas campus is underway today. Shared electric scooters are now in Fayetteville and on the U of A campus. And the university reports that through the Thanksgiving holiday week, no major accidents involving the e-scooters have been reported. Still, the helmet giveaway is being operated through the campus's Office for Sustainability. The 50 helmets, available on a first-come, first-served basis, were donated by Bell Helmets. The Faye W. Bozeman College of Public Health at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in Little Rock will be the first academic program in the state to offer a Master of Science in Healthcare Data Analytics next fall. The two-year, 36-credit-hour program will train individuals with the analytical and computer skills needed for data science positions. The program will borrow from courses in the College of Public Health and the College of Medicine at UAMS and will include online and in-person courses. And tomorrow, on Ozarks at Large, we learn about the rules of law surrounding contempt of court.
I think some people have a problem with contempt because it is, in a way, unbridled power for judges because they can control what happens in their courtroom and decide. To some people, it might seem arbitrary that one court can do it and one court can't.
That's on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 p.m. on 91.3 KUAF.
Support comes from Archon Plus, providing digital and offset printing, graphic design, promotional items, and a variety of business services. Located just off College Avenue at 461 East Township in Fayetteville, Archon has been locally owned and operated for over 30 years. Printing NWA.com or 444-7711 for more. Sona, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, and Walton Arts Center present The Return of the Snowman, a family concert at 2 p.m. December 22nd, featuring a screening of the hit children's film The Snowman with live orchestral soundtrack performed under the baton of Maestro Paul Haas. 443-5600 or sonamusic.org.
And this is Ozarks at Large. The Fayetteville Women's Concert Series is wrapping up its second season later this month on the 13th with a performance by Sarah Lothan at 612 Coffee House and Bar. Presented by nonprofit organization Bulldozer Health, the series highlights women musicians and raises money for both them and the nonprofit. Sarah recently came to the Furman Garner Performance Studio along with Wendy Love Edge, founder of Bulldozer Health, to talk with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda about the series.
This is our second year doing the series. The first year, the nonprofit that benefited was a different one here in Fayetteville called Spinster Haven Elder Tree. And so I've been around artists and musicians and dancers my whole life. I'm part of the art community as well. And I've noticed that women seem to, you know, get backburnered a lot in the music industry especially. I think it's a little bit different in some of the other arts, but especially when you look at mainstream music, the statistics are really low as far as inclusion of women. If you listen to the radio, you know, about 17% in 2018, about 17% of the songs that you hear are written or performed by women. So that being said, I really wanted to focus on local women here in the Fayetteville community and highlight them as part of the series and really talk about that in the community so that we can hopefully change those statistics locally, because what you do locally impacts nationally.
Sarah, what's your background in music?
I got started at around 16 years old. I started gigging, just playing all covers with my acoustic guitar, and started playing like just all over Northwest Arkansas. Like downtown Rogers was sort of my scene, like where I started. I went to high school there at Arkansas Arts Academy. And just played little local bar gigs and raised some money like doing that for college, and then went to school for music business. And I went to Oklahoma City for that. I went to the Academy of Contemporary Music and stayed for about like a year and a half, gained some knowledge there, but then decided to move back to Fayetteville because the market here for live music is just a lot greater than sort of what I was seeing, at least at my level in Oklahoma City. So came back here, am now playing in a band we've been playing for a couple of years called Makin' Loaf. And we've started like going out of state, and now we're playing, you know, we're playing all these places in Oklahoma City, everywhere. So yeah, this is just like a good place to start.
When you got into music, did you take notice of these statistics that we were talking about? Did you notice that there were not as many women performing?
Either
on a local level or on the radio?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, I was always kind of, you know, at that time I wasn't really going to see shows because I was so young.
Sure.
I couldn't really go and see shows where I played shows, really. But I would see, you know, tickets all the time, you know, other names. They have all the artists, like, playing for that month or that week. And, you know, I noticed, you know, maybe I'd see Ashton Barbary or like Samantha Hunt at the time, you know, that was all sort of happening around that same time. And that was about it. Everything else was all kind of like male artists. And I always felt a little bit afraid for myself, like just kind of like, oh, like, I hope that they, you know, want to have me back. I see that they, you know, have all of these guys playing country music and classic stuff that everyone wants to hear in bars. Mm-hmm. I wonder if I will be able to provide that and live up to that, you know, whatever that
right.
was.
Whatever that just stereotype is, or
yeah.
whatever they're looking for a genre. It must be really daunting as a female musician coming into that setting and really holding your ground and saying, I'm important too. What I have to say musically is important. Because when we look at the national statistics, it really looks kind of grim, you know. So kudos to you for sticking with it. And, you know, people definitely need to hear what you have to say. And that's one of the reasons we're doing this series. You know, Bulldozer Health has worked with musicians and artists throughout our project. They kind of understood the project from the beginning. You know, we help people to understand what health and wellness is and to access alternative health care. And when I first started talking to musicians about doing benefit concerts in the very beginning, they totally understood, because many of them don't have health insurance anyway, so they've found other natural ways to heal. And then I realized, oh, with this platform, we can also do things like this, where we're highlighting women in music and helping to bring them forward and raise money at the same time.
What are some of the benefits that you've seen come out, or have you seen benefits come out of having these, you know, women-only or women-focused events?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I see, so when people come and enjoy the music, and I always get up and just do a short short introduction to Bulldozer Health and talk about why we're doing it like we are today. What I've seen is the raising awareness in the community. Many people are shocked by the statistics, you know, and so. I feel like they leave the events thinking, oh, maybe I'll take a closer look at some of these female artists. And I love that, you know, because as we raise awareness and people understand that this is important, we want to, you know, I'm a feminist. I'm not looking to have women take over, but, you know, some equality would be lovely. Don't you think, Sarah?
I do. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
When you're planning your set list for this event, or maybe you already have it planned if you've thought that far in advance.
Oh, yeah.
Have you given any thought to, as you think about it, have you given any thought to what type of songs you would like to perform since it is an event highlighting women, or do you just want to do what you do and not change anything?
I think the best thing I can do is just do what I do. I really enjoy... I definitely am always like thinking about my audience. Like I'm always kind of thinking about like, you know, what do I feel like these people like kind of need to hear right now? And you know, I might play some acoustic guitar finger picking stuff, and then I might pick up my electric guitar and do something a little more rowdy and rock and roll stuff, because I love rock. That's my favorite thing to do, is like sing.
Yeah.
Really like pushy vocals, because I like to be sort of in your face. And I feel like that's what sort of the female industry needs a little more of. It's just like that in your face, you know, mm-hmm. I don't care. And you don't have to play a specific type of music to achieve that. It's just
I've seen that with we've had all different genres in the series. This year particularly, and all different age ranges too. And you know, that really putting it forward, you know, from women who have been playing music, you know, maybe they're now, you know, in their mid or late 60s, and they have people who have been following them for, you know, 30, 40 years who show up, and then new people too, and they really bring it, you know, and I love that, because I think we need to get away from being ageist too, you know. I don't have any stats on that, but that's a whole nother thing, you know.
Oh, man. That's a real thing for sure. Like, I know a lot of the women in the music community, and I've worked a lot with, you know, people of all ages mm-hmm. that are on all different levels of success. And I have seen specifically, like older women just get treated a little differently mm-hmm. in a way that, it's just like.
Oh, absolutely.
Shameful.
Anything else we should know?
So Guitar Center donated an acoustic guitar to help fund the series. And so we've been selling raffle tickets for that. They're only $1 each. There's other, and we'll continue to sell tickets for the acoustic guitar and pull the winner at Sarah's show on December 13th.
Okay, and you can get raffle tickets at the concert.
At the concert, or if they want to reach out and send an email or a message through the website, I'll be happy to meet them and sell them some tickets anytime.
Okay. Well, congratulations on another year of the series, and
thank
look
you.
Forward to next year.
Thank you so much.
That was Wendy Love Edge and Sarah Lothan speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajda at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Wendy says she intends to continue the series next year, but may reduce the frequency of concerts from monthly to quarterly. She's also looking for a woman-owned business interested in hosting them. The final concert in this year's series begins at 7 p.m. December 13th at 612 Coffee House and Bar in Fayetteville. Tickets and more information are available at bulldozerhealth.org. University of Arkansas Fort Smith volleyball team will open play in the NCAA Division II tournament Thursday evening in Denver. UAFS is seated fourth in its regional. Will face Texas A&M Commerce at 6 our time. Both UAFS and A&M Commerce are members of the Lone Star Conference. They've already faced each other twice this season, winning the matches on each other's courts. South Central Regional will take place through Saturday. UAFS will need to win 3 matches in 3 days to advance to the Elite Eight. That, too, will be hosted in Denver. And the National Weather Service is expecting a few clouds to move into the region tonight. Lows to drop between 32 and 34. Tomorrow, partly sunny with highs around 54 in northwest Arkansas, near 60 in the Arkansas River Valley. Tuesday night, partly cloudy conditions, lows in the mid-30s.
Where will the OSIRIS-REx probe land? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. The OSIRIS-REx spacecraft, known as the Origins Spectral Interpretation Resource Identification Security Regolith Explorer, currently orbiting the asteroid Bennu, needs to take a sample of the rubbly surface to return back to Earth. But what portion of Bennu's surface will the probe take? It is not as easy as just swooping down, grab a pile of space dirt, and then fly away. Each part of the asteroid has brought us closer to understanding how asteroids are made and the compositions that make these rubble piles into fascinating structures. Currently, NASA mission planners have narrowed down the potential landing sites to four locations. Fortunately, the mission team has 300 days to carefully decide on the site to touch down and get a sample. The four sites are named after native birds of Egypt, which is kingfisher, nightingale, osprey, and sandpiper. Once landed on one of these sites, OSIRIS-REx has enough fuel for three attempts for a touch-and-go grabbing of asteroid dirt and will collect about 60 grams of material for safe return to Earth. So for comparison, this is about the weight of an alkaline C battery. Even though it may seem tiny, it will be the largest sample returned to Earth by another surface since the Apollo program. A primary and backup site will be announced later this year and will begin surveying the primary site in early 2020. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.ur.edu.
Scratching the Surface with your host, Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM, KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville. This is a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas.
It's that time of year again. Our annual Christmas show is Wednesday, December 4th at the Fayetteville Public Library. We'll have musical performances by Dandelion Heart, John Henry, and the St. Paul's Episcopal Church Children's Choir. We'll also hear a reading of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer by Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Admission is free, and we'll be collecting non-perishable food items for our annual Giving Tree initiative. Donations will benefit Antioch for Youth and Family in Fort Smith. The show starts at 6:30. Hope to see you there.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Junie C. Cobb was born in Hot Springs in 1896. The Garland County native was a talented multi-instrumentalist who was a featured performer on banjo, saxophone, clarinet, and piano in noted bands as jazz music emerged. Cobb was in his late 20s when he joined the phenomenally influential Creole Jazz Band, led by early jazz innovator Joe King Oliver. Junie Cobb played banjo in the band, an important position. Banjo, with African origins, was a prominently featured instrument in jazz, blues, hillbilly, and Dixieland bands through the 1920s and 1930s. The banjo would soon thereafter fall out of fashion in jazz and blues, but was an important instrument in the development of each of these musical genres. The banjo's demise may have had little effect on Junie Cobb. He had plenty of other skills he could fall back on as a musician.
After Junie C. Cobb's time with the Joe King Oliver Creole Jazz Band, Cobb joined the Jimmy Noon Band, heard here in 1928. Junie C. Cobb and Noon were contemporaries, with Jimmy Noon being 1 year older, born in 1895 in Cutoff, Louisiana. Like Cobb, Noon played clarinet and saxophone, and Noon had also played with King Oliver, as well as greats like Earl Father Hines. Spa City's Junie C. Cobb is heard here performing Mojo Strut with still another early jazz group, the Parham Pickett Apollo Serenaders. Canadian pianist Tiny Parham leads the band. In the mid-1940s, Junie C. Cobb began performing solo piano, but the Arkansasian wouldn't be confined to that either. Cobb formed his own band in the late 1940s and played saxophone and clarinet in the group. Junie C. Cobb and his band toured Europe in 1950. Cobb also continued to perform as a solo pianist, especially around his adopted hometown of Chicago, Illinois, until his retirement from music in 1955. Since then, Junie C. Cobb's reputation as an early great in the genre and a multi-instrumentalist musical forefather has only grown in jazz circles. Junie C. Cobb died in Chicago, Illinois, on New Year's Day, 1970. Here in its entirety is Willie the Weeper by the esteemed King Oliver Jazz Band, featuring Junie C. Cobb of Hot Springs in Garland County. King Oliver Band with Willie the Weeper, featuring Junie C. Cobb of Hot Springs in Garland County. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs since 1998.
And contributors to Ozarks at Large today included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, and Zuzanna Sitek. Timothy Dennis mastered our show. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Caitlin Ahrens, and it is produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It's written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can find Daryl at darylsean.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Salisaw, Oklahoma. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. We are available as a free podcast at almost any place where you can find podcasts. You can learn much more about us and listen to past editions of our show at ozarksatlarge.com. More news from our region tomorrow morning at 5:30 and 7:30, newscast with Antoinette Grajeda. We're back with a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon and 7. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your Monday.